Thanks, brother. All right, friends, very good to see you. We're in Acts chapter 25, and we're going to cover these next two chapters over the next two classes. So I'm not sure how far we'll get tonight. We probably will get into chapter 26, I'm not sure. But that's okay, because there's a lot in 26 that we can definitely spill over into next class. All right. Before we begin, Brother Allen's going to lead us in a word of prayer.
Let us pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this opportunity to gather together as a family and to study your word in this middle of the week. We ask that you be with Mike as he teaches us, and may we use what we learn in our daily lives, and may we be examples to the community and our friends and people we come in contact with daily as examples of Christians and of you to the world. We ask that you be with us throughout the rest of this week and lead us and guide us and save us eternally. It's in your Son's name we pray. Amen.
Amen. Okay, Acts 25 is where we are. And to, you know, get a running start to give an idea where we are in the story of Acts. At this time, we know, based on previous chapters, that Paul was in Jerusalem. That's where his imprisonment started. And, of course, he had his accusers, and he's already presented his case a couple of times in Jerusalem. Then there was this plot by 40 men to kill Paul, and they were not going to eat or drink until Paul was dead. And so we know the commander got word of this through Paul's nephew. And so the decision was to get Paul out of town. And that's what the commander did. And it's not like he just assigned a couple of soldiers to escort Paul to Caesarea. He had close to 500. He had foot soldiers, soldiers on horses, spearmen. I mean, this guy was protected. All right, he had just a wall of people and weapons around him. Which, any thoughts on why it would be so extreme like that? You know, why the commander would go to this length? I mean, there's a couple possibilities. Where's my running man? John was talking smack about running tonight. Okay, you're over there then. Okay, so I'm going to need you guys to make a lot of comments over there tonight.
All right. This is speculation on my part, but when he found out Paul was a Roman citizen,
bingo,
he knew he was going to be responsible for Paul. And,
right.
And if Paul died in his care or was assassinated, it'd be his own neck.
Right. Okay. Right. So knowing, I think that's it. I think that's it. That knowing Paul was a Roman citizen, you know, he wanted to go the extra mile to make sure Paul was protected. Not just protected, though, but to really, right, to save his own neck, right? Because he was about to scourge a Roman citizen, you know, until it was all discovered that he was in the fault. So now, you know, he's going above and beyond. But I think that's right. I think it's because of Paul's Roman citizenship. So you have this, you know, this aggressive effort to protect Paul, okay? And like I said, it may have been an overlapping reason there, too. But he knew how the Jews were. He knew how radical they were. And so he was doing his part to get Paul safely out of town. Again, I wouldn't have any problem saying that was all the providence of God. So he gets to Caesarea. And at Caesarea, the high priests and elders came to testify against Paul. And now they're before Felix, the governor, as what we can see in chapter 24. Which James covered. And he presents his case there before those people, and then he presents it to Felix and his wife themselves later on. And that's that great text where Felix, you know, says, "Go away for now, at a more convenient time I will call for you." I mean, that's a great text. you know, of putting it off, of putting off obeying the gospel, putting off surrendering to the Lord. And there's no record of this man ever changing his mind and calling for Paul or of obeying the gospel. So there's another good example of how you don't want to put this off. When you are inclined to do it, you see the need to do it, you have the opportunity to do it, you need to do it. Because we have a way of talking ourselves out of things when the mood changes. All right, so he's there. He presents his case to Felix. And then eventually Felix is replaced in his civil position and political position. And so Festus is now reigning, as it talks about at the end of chapter 24. But we know that, as it says, that the last verse, Felix, wanting to do the Jews a favor, left Paul bound. And so that's where he was, okay? So, chapter 25 then, that's the setting, and it says, when Festus had come to the province, after 3 days, he went up from Caesarea to Jerusalem. So here's the newly appointed governor, okay, going to Jerusalem. Then the high priest and the chief men of the Jews informed him against Paul, and they petitioned him, asking a favor against him, that he would summon him to Jerusalem while they lay in ambush along the road to kill him. But Festus answered that Paul should be kept at Caesarea, and that he himself was going there shortly. Therefore, he said, let those who have authority among you go down with me and accuse this man to see if there is any fault in him. So here's a question. You know, what would the newly appointed governor know about the Jewish leaders based on his little exchange there with them? What would he know about them? Or what could he have known about them based on, you know, just this little bit of interaction he had with them? I mean, he just comes to town, he just gets to Jerusalem, and he meets up with these men. And so what can he know about them? I mean, just random things, not just one thing, but anything stand out about what he could know? You know, again, just as his 3 days into this, okay? He's just 3 days he went to Jerusalem. So he knows he's dealing with some radical people, right? I mean, because what are they wanting to do? They're still wanting to kill Paul. And how are they wanting Festus to get involved in that? Right. Get him out of protection from Caesarea. Get him to Jerusalem. Get him on the road, you know, exposed. And we'll take care of it from there. You know, we'll lay an ambush along the road to kill him. Just meeting these people, or at least meeting them in his official capacity, I would say. He's just meeting them. So, I mean, can you imagine the impression he has of these people? These are God's people, right? Supposed to be. Supposed to be, I mean, by the world standards, they were supposed to be the people of God. And yet he sees how they're acting. You know, the corruption, the dishonesty, you know, the deceitful behavior and the hate that's still there. All right, so he says no. Okay, you guys got a beef with this guy. You come back to town with me, and we'll do this right. You know, we'll have this man accused properly to see if there's any fault in him. All right, so in verse 6, and let me know if you have a question or comment. It says, when he had remained among them more than 10 days, he went down to Caesarea. And I know some say Caesarea, but I've always learned it's Caesarea, so that's the way it is. And the next day, sitting on the judgment seat, he commanded Paul to be brought. When he had come, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood about and laid many serious complaints against Paul, which they could not prove, while he answered for himself. In verse 8, it says, neither against the law of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar, have I offended in anything at all. But Festus, wanting to do the Jews a favor, answered Paul and said, "Are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and there be judged before me concerning these things?" Okay. So you see the text. Okay, they eventually do come back to Caesarea, and they're all there again, and Paul's having to explain himself once more. And he says, look, these guys, they don't have anything, okay? There's no proof that I did anything to this nation, anything to Rome, anything against Caesar, anything against this temple. There's nothing that they can say factually that I did. And in fact, it says they could not prove this. In verse 7, the many serious complaints they had against Paul. They had no proof. So that much was evident. But it says that Festus, wanting to do the Jews a favor, answered Paul and said, "Are you willing to go up to Jerusalem?" Now, out of curiosity, what was the favor he was willing to do for the Jews? What could that have been? And he's wanting to do these people a favor. All right, put them on trial there at Jerusalem. Yeah, I mean, that, you know, that wouldn't be beyond the realm of possibility of taking it back to their court, so to speak. You know, he's trying to get on their good side, it looks like. I mean, it looks like here's a political maneuver, you know, to try and have peace with this a huge section of this territory, you know, the Jewish people. So, he can't ignore their influence, okay? Any other thoughts on what that favor could have been besides just, you know, getting him back to stay in court there?
It looks like a compromise, but he doesn't know how to handle the situation.
Right, okay, yeah. He is definitely uncertain about how to handle the situation. That's definitely the case as this thing's going to continue to unfold. He's not sure how to deal with it. You have a possible thought of, relieving himself from this. Part of me wondered if this is going back to that deal they offered him back in Jerusalem. You know, you get this man to Jerusalem and we'll ambush him. You know, part of me is wondering if he's now willing to compromise, you know, and let them do what they wanted to do initially. I don't know. It just kind of stood out when I was reading that, wondering if that's what was at stake here, you know, if that's what he wanted to do. So as soon as Speedy Gonzalez gets down here, we'll let you make your comment.
Paul makes it very clear. The governor knows there are no charges against him. He knows there's nothing there. He states it in
right.
No uncertain terms. You well know.
Yep.
Which means Felix is in, or Festus is in a position where, unlike the commander, if Paul gets assassinated on the way down there, it's not that big a deal to him. So apparently this is such a big issue. It's been 2 years. The Jews are still so angry at Paul, still festering this hatred toward him, that this would have been something that Festus would have heard about very quickly, because it's unlikely there were any other prisoners sitting there in the palace
mm-hmm.
waiting for him.
Right, okay.
And so it looked like he was just was willing to let it be assassinated, because assassination, political assassination, literal assassination, was a common Roman thing.
Hmm.
So it would not be something that him, as a governor, that would reflect badly on him as a governor, unlike the commander.
Hmm. Okay, all right. You know, especially since it's so new of a case for him. Okay. So, again, the idea, the concept of him possibly passing the buck, you're going to see this unfold a little bit more of him, again, just not knowing what to do with this situation. I can see that. I like how Paul is realizing, okay, this guy doesn't know what he's doing because as soon as Festus says, okay, you want to go to Jerusalem with this? Paul says, no, we're going to Caesar. I stand at Caesar's judgment seat, he says in verse 10, where I ought to be judged. To the Jews, I've done no wrong, as you very well know. For if I'm an offender or have committed anything deserving of death, I do not object to dying. But if there is nothing in these things of which these men accuse me, no one can deliver me to them. I appeal to Caesar. So he's putting things together himself, Paul is, you know, about what's happening in this scene. And obviously, he has the good sense and the good judgment God is giving him. But let me ask you this. Based on what we just read about Paul, how was the providence of God at work for Paul up until this point? What could we say about that? I mean, you know, again, providence is something you see in hindsight, looking back. You can, you know, you can connect the dots. But what's happening here? I mean, how can we see the providence of God at work in this man's life? Any thoughts on that? What now? Okay, so knowing what to say, even? Okay. Giving him the judgment to respond to this? No doubt. I mean, certainly it's been to Paul's favor and benefit to respond the way he has. You know, I mean, you can see that, look how close he was. Look how close he was to having a decision made against him to where he would have most likely died from it. But obviously he had this other option, and Paul was utilizing that. And this all, again, goes back into the big scene of what Jesus had said about Paul testifying for him. Now, let me ask you this, based on what we just read, what did Paul, let me see this part right here. But see, Rome, that's what I, yeah, because appealing to Caesar, right? I mean, that's not like back in Jerusalem. He had to go to Rome to do that. You see, that's where he would appeal to Caesar. But see, notice that is getting Paul to Rome, even though that's not the way he intended it to happen. Certainly that's not the way he was expecting it to happen during his ministry. But it's starting to happen that way, you know, and it's presenting him that opportunity to get to that part of the world safely. All right. But he says now, I haven't done anything. They can't prove this. He says in verse 11, if I'm an offender, committed anything deserving of death, I do not object to dying. So let me ask you this. What did Paul think of capital punishment? What did he think of it? He approved of it, right? Yeah. I mean, you can see that through the implication. Whoever said that, you can see that he understood that if he had done anything that warranted that type of judgment, he didn't oppose it. Obviously, if he didn't oppose it for himself, he wouldn't have opposed it for other people. You know, sometimes at different times, brethren have wrestled over this idea of capital punishment, whether or not we can be in favor of that or support that. Well, even Paul, to me, at least reading this, seems to be saying, okay, if I deserve it, I deserve it. And he won't oppose that if he deserved it. And that was a role that God gave the government in Romans 13, you know, to punish evildoers. That's a reality. Not saying that he justifies the abuse. Obviously, that's not what's at stake here. But the overall concept, I think, can be seen in the comments given here in Acts 25. All right, so it says that Festus, when he had conferred with the council, answered and said, you've appealed to Caesar? To Caesar you shall go. So now he's got his boat ticket, so to speak, to go to Rome. Now the stage is set for him to get there. And it's through his appeal through the legal system here. All right, anything on that section before we move on from it? All right. Well, we see in verse 13, Acts 25, after some days, it says that King Agrippa and Bernice came to Caesarea to greet Festus. When they had been there many days, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, there is a certain man left a prisoner by Felix, about whom the chief priests and the elders of the Jews informed me when I was in Jerusalem asking for a judgment against him. To them I answered, it is not the custom of the Romans to deliver any man to destruction before the accused meets the accusers face to face and has opportunity to answer for himself concerning the charge against him. So you can see him now trying to get a different opinion on how to deal with Paul and this, the legal options and the legal judgment against him. Because, I mean, he's the law enforcement, the governor is, and he's not sure what to do. So a higher official comes to town, and as soon as they have opportunity, he says, okay, you got to help me with this one, because this is one that I'm not sure what to do with. And it just so happens that it says in verse 22 that Agrippa said to Festus, I also would like to hear the man myself. And tomorrow, he said, you shall hear him. All right, so you have this King Agrippa who is before Festus. And this, of course, is part of the Herod family, that reigning dynasty among the Jews at this time, appointed by Rome, of course. But we see that in light of the history of this family, Herod Agrippa II is the person we're talking about now in chapter 25. He's the one who's going to be married to his sister Bernice, as we just read in the text. Bernice is his wife. And his sister Drusilla is the one who was married to Felix, as we read in the previous chapter. Now, Agrippa II is the son of Agrippa I, who was the one who killed James in Acts 12. And their uncle, Antipas, was the one who was in power when John the Baptist was beheaded, and then, of course, when Jesus was crucified. So you can see the significance of this family in the New Testament story. Okay, so that's who we're standing before right now, the current king over this territory. And it says that Festus is, again, presenting this case to the king. I'm going to go back here and look at verse 16, where it says, he gave his reasoning for keeping Paul confined. Verse 18, when the accuser stood up, now this is him talking to the king now. This is the governor talking to the king. When the accuser stood up, they brought no accusation against him of such things as I supposed. You know, in other words, when he got word of this case in Jerusalem, when he went there, he thought it would be over something else. But when he actually heard the case, it was not what he thought it would be. But they had some questions against him about their own religion and about a certain Jesus who had died, whom Paul affirmed to be alive. And because I was uncertain of such things, I asked whether he was willing to go to Jerusalem and there be judged concerning these matters. But when Paul appealed to be reserved for the decision of Augustus, I commanded him to be kept till I could send him to Caesar. And that's when Agrippa said, okay, I want to hear from the guy as well. So, let me ask you this. Just even what we just read just then. How is Christianity benefiting from Paul's imprisonment? How is Christianity benefiting from Paul's imprisonment? You know, because to the average person, give this guy free rein. You know, let him get out there to the streets and the houses like he had been doing. You know, let this guy loose and do the things he was doing. But is there a benefit to his confinement? And if so, how is Christianity benefiting from Paul's confinement? Hey, John? You got a hand right there, brother. Thank
you. The gospel spread to Rome and from Rome many places.
Okay, yeah. So the gospel's definitely going to spread to Rome through his efforts and through this arrangement that Paul's in. Yeah, definitely the spread of the gospel to other parts of the world is, I mean, how can that, you know, that is a reality. So Paul hasn't shelved the gospel until he's free. You know, he's still preaching it. Go ahead, brother.
He was in. he did what he could to further the cause of the gospel.
Exactly.
And back in 24, he was given the freedom that people could come, you know, to him. So he could receive friends. So he had opportunity to continue to do good in that situation.
Right, right. So, yeah, he still had opportunity to do good and interact and still be involved in the Lord's church, and especially the spread of the gospel, even though it would not have been favorable by most people's standards. But that, I believe, again, is the providence of God protecting this man and still creating, you know, creating pathways of influence. You know, look at the people who are hearing the gospel. You know, because here's the governor saying, yeah, the Jews had something about him, you know, something about their religion and something about this man named Jesus that Paul says came back to life, you know, from the dead. So, you know, there you have that level of the government hearing about this. You know, the chief of the chief, so to speak. Even that layer of society is being penetrated with the gospel because of Paul and his confinement. So, you know, how can this help us endure our trials in life? You know, how can Paul's example help us endure our trials in life? Is there another comment? Okay, go ahead, brother.
Well, I was just going to say that if you go back to Acts chapter 9, Jesus, when he appeared to Ananias, tells him that he's chosen Paul to bear my name before Gentiles, kings, and the children of Israel.
Right. Right on. And you just ruined my next point. But yeah, you're right on. I mean, that's exactly right. You know, when I showed you the charts earlier, I didn't think you would actually bring up those comments. But yeah. No, that's it, Gary. You're exactly right. Because, you know, when the time comes for Paul to, or at least for Agrippa to hear what Paul had to say, it wasn't like the two of them just met up. As Gary's referencing, it is a whole collection of people in the government who are listening to this. And it says in verse 23 of Acts 25, the next day when Agrippa and Bernice had come with great pomp and had entered the auditorium with the commanders and the prominent men of the city at Festus's command, Paul was brought in. And that was my next question is, you know, what prophecy did this fulfill from Jesus? And Gary got right to it. In chapter 9, that's exactly what Jesus said through Ananias. Said that, you know, because Ananias said, well, hey, we've heard about this guy. He's killing everybody. Why would I go see him? Jesus says, go, for he is a chosen vessel of mine to bear my name before Gentiles, kings, and the children of Israel. So there it is. You know, way back, years prior to this, that was the promise. God had already had this in mind and was navigating toward that. See in the future. So exactly. I mean, you know, how is Christianity benefiting from Paul's imprisonment? Well, different segments of society are hearing the gospel that they would not have. I mean, think about it. How could the governor not know about Jesus? That seems to be his thinking, right? Something about this certain Jesus. Something about him dying and coming back, as Paul's talking about. Well, why is that? How could he not know that? But he didn't, right? And so Paul's effort, every time he's doing this, every time he's telling this story, the people are hearing it, and more doors are opening. All right, so, you know, going back to the other question, you know, what about our own trials? How can that help us? You know, how can Paul's circumstance help us endure our trials in life? What do you think about that?
By our actions.
Right, okay. By our actions, okay. Help me out on that. What do you mean by that? By our actions?
Well, if we, like you say in long roundabout way, you put up or shut up.
Okay. All right. You know, the, okay. So I guess the concept is enduring because of what the encouragement and the, you know, the evidence it can provide people, you know, with us being steadfast like that. I mean, that's a benefit of us enduring our trials. We do preach to the world, so to speak. Is there another one over here?
Yeah, I think that it teaches us that no matter where we find ourselves in our lives, whether it where we work now, where we're going to work in the future, the neighborhood we live in, the people we interact with when we shop or our friends or whatever, no matter what our circle of influence is, if it changes throughout our lives for whatever reason, there's still going to be people within that circle who are not Christians that we can reach.
Right.
And just like, you know, with him here, his circle of influence shifted big time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he still continued to preach Jesus. He continued to preach the word, and it shows his faith, you know, regardless of where he is, he's going to continue to do what he's supposed to do.
Yeah.
And I think it just encourages us to do the same thing, even if, you know, no matter where we are. You know, sometimes we get transferred with jobs, or we have to move to help out family members who are getting older, or whatever the circumstance is, there's going to be people within our circle of influence that we can reach out to.
Right.
And we just need to know that as long as we're doing that, there's people there that like you pointed out that, you know, he may have heard about Jesus, but the question is, did he hear the truth about Jesus, or did he hear you know, some other false claims about him?
Mm-hmm.
And now Paul has this opportunity to actually tell the truth, which is what converts people.
Yeah, you know, that's true. It gives people the opportunity to hear it. You know, it makes you wonder, just makes you wonder, what if God's putting us in that, or allowing us to be in that circumstance for the sphere we might touch because of what we're going through? I mean, because, again, the normal person would not want to be confined. Nobody likes their liberty stripped from them. Nobody does. But Paul's situation is being used to reach other people. What about you? I mean, it's just something to think about. I just really believe in the providence of God. And he does things in our lives, and he may put us in certain circumstances because we can be effective in reaching other people or in upholding the truth and exposing the people to the truth because of what we're going through. It's just, I don't know. It just, to me, it just seems like a natural conclusion from this story. All right, so he's before everybody of the ruling class, okay? Great pomp, okay? The king shows up. It's not like, yeah, well, the king's here. No, I mean, it's just everybody's celebrating the fact the king is there. And while the king is there, Paul gets to speak. Go ahead.
You know, when I think of Paul being in this situation, I think of a parallel situation of Joseph.
Oh.
When he's there, second command of Egypt, and his brothers come up, and he said, and Joseph says to him, said that God used me for a purpose in Egypt. You meant for me to do harm.
Yeah.
But God had a purpose for me, and God meant it for good. And I think it's a similar principle here,
right,
that those people in Jerusalem, those Jews, were wanting to kill him.
Exactly.
But God had a purpose for Paul.
Right.
And put him in there in that purpose. And some of that, it has not been revealed to us, but some of it has, enough that we can draw a lesson from it. And I think we see a very strong parallel. And Paul probably even thought about that when he was in that prison.
Hmm. Yeah. Which, again, connect it to us. I mean, could we not think that? You know, could we not trust God to think, okay, there's a purpose to all this? You know, we can see it in other people's lives or other stories of the Bible. There was a purpose. Like you said, Joseph, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. Well, these Jews meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. And the same thing could be with you. There are people who may mean it for evil with what they're doing, but God can use it for good. It's a great thought. Okay, so here he's presenting himself, okay, before these people, prominent people. And it says in verse 24 that Festus said, okay, so Festus gets up first. And he says, King Agrippa and all the men who are here present with us, you see this man about whom the whole assembly of the Jews petitioned me both at Jerusalem and here, crying out that he was not fit to live any longer. But when I found that he had committed nothing deserving of death, and that he himself had appealed to Augustus, I decided to send him. I have nothing certain to write to my Lord concerning him. Therefore, I have brought him out before you, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after the examination has taken place, I may have something to write. For it seems to me unreasonable to send a prisoner and not to specify the charges against him. So, what about this question? What was Festus's dilemma, or dilemmas even, but dilemma with Paul's case? What was his dilemma? Why are we having this meeting, so to speak? I mean, at the surface level, I mean, you look at what's about to happen. I mean, he's about to send this guy to Caesar. One second, brother.
Get answers.
Sir?
Answers.
To get answers? Okay. You would wait till Alan almost got there just in case LR was going
to
say that.
Well, you know, you're not going to send somebody up to Caesar for trial and not have a bona fide, rock-solid reason to put on there.
Right.
Because Caesar's going to look at you and say, hey, what's this guy doing down here in Caesarea? He doesn't know what he's doing. So
exactly.
You don't send somebody up there because it's basically your neck's in the sling in a sense, too. So you're going to send somebody up there with a good case for Caesar to hear.
Okay, good. Yeah, that's very reasonable. You know, because you're going to the highest court in the land, and you better have a legitimate reason to send him to the Supreme Court, if you will, you know, for our parallel. So, okay, he's trying to figure out what do I say? You know, when I send this guy to Caesar that he's appealed to, what do I say? Because it just doesn't seem reasonable to me to send him without specifying the charges against him. And so he's bringing all these guys in, especially the king. Hey, okay, I couldn't. You tell me. Okay, I want your judgment on this. All right, so that's the setting. And that's how chapter 25 ends. But real quickly, though, it does transition into chapter 26, where Agrippa responds. Now, anything you want to say before we move on from chapter 25? I think we can see the setting, right? We can see what's happening. I mean, he is looking for answers, like John just said. The governor's looking for answers to deal with Paul. All right, so chapter 26 then, just going to touch the first part of this. It says that Agrippa said to Paul in verse 1, "You are permitted to speak for yourself." And here's what Paul says. Now think about it. Here, before all these people. Paul stretched out his hand and answered for himself, "I think myself happy, King Agrippa, because today I shall answer for myself before you concerning all these things of which I'm accused by the Jews, especially because you are an expert in all customs and questions which have to do with the Jews. Therefore, I beg you to hear me patiently." Now, I have no doubt that what Paul was saying there was genuine, was sincere, was certainly different than what Tertullus, the crafty attorney, said earlier, you know, in using flattery. I think this is all genuine. I think he's saying, King Agrippa, I'm very thankful to have this opportunity to address you. Now, let me ask you this. What was different about Paul's case before Agrippa right now that was different in comparison to the other cases he had before other leaders and rulers? What was different? That's it. Agrippa knew the Jews. Okay? Now, how would that be significant? Why would that be significant with what Paul's about to say? Agrippa knew the Jews. That's exactly right. But why was that significant? Okay, that he would have, all right, the more opportunity to be unbiased, to hear Paul objectively, which he has not been given so far, okay? Because here's a man that he could reason with to show, you know, the prophecies and the culture of that nation and why he did what he did in departing from his calling or his life as a Jew. You know, you would have somebody who intimately knew that, understood what that meant, you know, to be a Jew. And, of course, what was expected of Jews. And here's a man who has the highest authority in the immediate area, you know, as far as local rulers. So guess what it does? You know, you have Paul in this situation, and a man who has relatively good knowledge, and Paul's about to explain it to him. And guess what might happen from this? He might be converted. You know, this might be an opportunity to not only explain this, but it's an opportunity to probably convert this man. And that's what he's going for. You know, Paul is talking about that, and he can, as we'll see, the famous verse from this chapter as he's going through this, he says, I know you know what I'm talking about, you know, and how I'm persuaded that you can be a Christian, you know, and that's that great statement the king himself says in verse 28, you almost persuade me to be a Christian. So, again, you know, how does this apply to us? Is there anything to apply to us? Is there anything that can be applicable to our circumstances in life? You know, and I just can't help but think that you just don't know what opportunities God will present you with, especially in preaching the gospel and in sharing the truth, which might indeed be the one moment or one opportunity somebody needs to hear the truth. You know, we just don't know. But what we can know from Paul is that when we are passionate, when we're dedicated, when we're knowledgeable, when we're converted, when we've prepared ourselves, when we're sincere, anything can happen. You know, we can know our story, and we can know why we're a Christian and how we got here. And that's what he's about to do. I can tell you how I got here. And it's enough to at least prompt this guy to think about doing the same thing himself. Great opportunity. And there's no way King Agrippa would have got this reading the evening paper, right? Or the morning paper, whatever. He would have never had this opportunity. It was just through Paul. And how can you not see the hand of God in this? And certainly praise God for that. What if he's doing that with you? What if? What if in your circles of life, he's doing the very same thing? Somebody who needed to hear the truth, who can benefit from hearing the truth, and they're going to hear the truth because of your example. Okay? All right. Anything else on that? Okay. There's still plenty we can keep going. A couple minutes? Oh, 1 minute? 2 minutes. Okay. Yeah, so we're, okay. So he's going to get into his background as a Jew. And that's why he's saying, look, I'm grateful that I get to tell my story, okay? I'm really grateful for this opportunity. But listen, it's not just Agrippa who's about to hear this. It's everybody who's there about to hear this. And, of course, this record that God has provided us with has given other people opportunity to hear the story. So he says, my manner of life from my youth, which was spent from the beginning among my own nation at Jerusalem, all the Jews know. They knew me from the first, if they were willing to testify that according to the strictest sect of our religion, I lived a Pharisee. And now I stand and am judged for the hope of the promise made by God to our fathers. To this promise, our 12 tribes, earnestly serving God night and day, hope to attain. For this hope's sake, King Agrippa, I am accused by the Jews. So you can see how he's approaching this. I'm going to ask you about that on Sunday morning. And we'll wrap up chapter 26, Lord willing, on Sunday. Thank you, friends.